This is Game Theory, a podcast about competition, strategy, and decision-making, hosted by me, Nick Andrews, and my brother Chris. In this episode, why does everything seem so bad? If you've ever caught yourself in a downward spiral for no apparent reason, you may not be alone. There is a treasure trove of evidence that suggests that bad things, whether it be violent news, sad stories, or general pessimism, is all around us. But still, it feels disproportionate, doesn't it? Well, it is. It turns out that we may be predisposed to negative and fearful thinking, even when we know, for a fact, that things aren't that bad. Maybe that's why it seems that no matter how much progress we, as a species or as a society, make, things are only getting worse. But it doesn't have to be that way. And welcome to episode 106 of Game Theory Podcast about competition strategy and decision making. And Chris is going to put the microphone closer to his mouth this time so that the YouTube video is even. Sorry. Steven.
I tried as hard as I could, but it wasn't good enough.
Well,
I sound good today, Nick? Do I sound okay?
You sound bueno, muy bueno. This video and podcast is a day late because I have what we used to call Coco, or the Rona, or the
Vin.
The Rona. Yeah, back when life was easier. Back when life was simpler in March of 2020.
Well, you know, I miss those times. I miss having an excuse to cancel any plan at any time. And that includes work plans. I can just say, oh, boss, sorry, I can't log in remotely today. I've got the coronavirus, which, as we all know, there's no natural defense to, so RIP, and the people are just okay with that. And now everything is accessible all the time because I can just log on anytime, anywhere. I'm really more accessible and more vulnerable to that kind of thing today. And I miss those days. So I hope you're living some nostalgia as you recover from this ultimately manageable
disease. I have been coughing up plenty
of
nostalgia, let me tell you. I've been very nostalgic couple of days.
I'm just proud of you for getting your nostalgia shot in advance.
Sure.
I'm sure you're up to date on your nostalgia.
I'm
boosters.
Actually not up to date. I totally forgot. And I had been forgetting for like the past, I don't know, 12 weeks. So now here I am. Whatever.
I mean,
I got the flu one early and COVID hadn't come out yet. So I was like, whatever. I just get it later. I just never did. Similar to like getting your license renewed or whatever.
Cycle and look, I mean, it's going to come back to bite you. So I guess you're all caught up one way or the other. Huh?
That's exactly right. It's going to come for all of us. So I have some interesting news, Chris. Do we love coin flip games and Equilibrium on this podcast?
Yes. Big coin flip guys.
In 1,502 basketball games, which amounts to just under 19 seasons, the Atlanta Hawks are 751 and 751.
No way.
Yep.
Are they really?
Yeah.
So
they were, Chris, they were 750 and 750 season. And it was amazing. And then they went 1-1. They're 751 and 751.
Good Lord. You know, I hope they keep this going forever. Somebody's got to set the standard for chance. It's like those psychics that say like, oh, I can use these divining rods to find water, mm-hmm. or I can figure out like when I can see someone's aura behind a blocked door or wall so I can tell or whatever. And they set up those experiments that's like, all right, there's 10 doors, so you should find 5 people if it's just random chance. And then wouldn't you know it, they find like 5 people.
Yeah. That's exactly 50%.
No better than so the Atlanta Hawks. Like, if somebody were to just guess, yeah, they would roughly make out even on the Hawks betting all time.
Yeah, and it's weird because they're up and they're like the second or third best team in the Eastern Conference. They make a little baby run, and then they're down and they're horrible, and then they're back up. But like if you told a casual NBA fan that, they'd be like, "That's the craziest thing I've ever heard." But then they'd also be like, "Yeah, that sounds right." That sounds about right. It's pretty.
So the Atlanta Hawks are the Fast and Furious movies of NBA franchises.
Yeah, there you go.
They're not very good, but they're not very bad.
They're not very bad. They make a lot of sense. I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
One other thing is that, get this, Chris, the Match Group. We haven't done a date. We have to do a dating episode on this now. I had run out of ideas for dating episodes, but it always is going to come back around. Match Group, which owns, Tinder, Match.com, and Hinge, I think, some big ones. They are being sued
by
people.
Let's find out who they own, because we've mentioned Match in the last episode, I think.
Yeah, they're being sued. Did I mention they're being sued? It's coming out more clearly.
So.
Yeah. So the allegations are that they're getting people addicted to swiping, and that the rumors are that they are assigning a point system rating on people's attractiveness, and that they're not supposed to do that. Tinder had done that. People found out about it, and they were grossed out by it. But now Hinge is saying, no, we've never done that. But people are like, yeah, no, they do that for sure.
That is straight out of Facebook's original playbook. Like the original Facebook, like Mark Zuckerberg coded in his Harvard dorm room to basically rate people on attractiveness. Wow, that's impressive. And by the way, I just looked it up. Match Group Inc., through its portfolio companies, provides digital technologies. The company's portfolio and brands includes Tinder, Hinge, Match, MeetIk, OkCupid, Pairs, Plenty of Fish, Azar, Hakuna, and other brands. That's according to Reuters.
Yeah, that makes sense. We gotta dive deeper into this, because everything I read about it is fascinating to me. It's just
let's try it.
We should probably do. We should have a discussion about that one of these days. See if there's anything else.
And we can talk about Love Is Blind too. You ever watch that?
Yeah, I'm caught up. I'm caught up as of this evening. New episodes today.
It's the only show that I've ever managed to find that consistently, it compulsively almost undermines its own premise.
Yeah.
Because the second those people get out of the pods, they're either relieved / thrilled to see, like, oh, great, my partner's hot.
Yep.
Or they are visibly upset that their partner is not what they wanted. Like, there's one guy in this season who's like, oh, she said she looks like Megan Fox. And then, like, she does not.
A lot of discussion about that person saying so, that's a theory. Because you get to win the game short term, but you lose the battle. Because you're like,
oh, yeah.
I actually don't look super. I look semi like Megan Fox, but not. Not like Megan Fox, who was like 19 in Transformers when you were a kid. Definitely don't look like that, Megan Fox.
We're not gonna criticize somebody for making that decision, because you got to make that decision. What we are gonna do is criticize an idiot for believing that. Right. Oh, I am now talking to Megan Fox, and that's what my expectation is.
Well,
and then being bummed out when it's actually not.
Love
the
Is Blind is facing quite a bit of criticism because they put someone in an incredibly unsafe situation last season, and that storyline was cut, and then she violated her NDA, and now they're countersuing. Oh yeah, there's drama, and there's a lot of people spilling the beans about this most recent season. I actually think Love Is Blind season 8 might not happen.
It was fun while it lasted, wasn't it?
Yeah, this is
the real dream.
Yep. Damn. Okay, so one other thing on news that I thought would be interesting from a game theory standpoint is Wendy's is trying out surge pricing, and they can go straight to hell.
I think Wendy's is not trying out surge pricing.
2025.
I think I saw that.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah, 2025, they are trying surge pricing, which for anybody who doesn't know what that is,
I thought I saw
that means
they denied that.
That would be pretty wild.
I don't know.
It was widely reported.
So CNN, 5 hours ago.
Okay.
We're recording this at the end of February. So 5 hours ago, an article by John Tofighi at CNN says, don't call Wendy's new pricing plan surge pricing.
Uh-huh.
In a blog post on Tuesday, the fast food chain explained that its test of new menus with prices that change throughout the day is not meant to cost more for customers.
Oh.
What? How can you say that?
That's surge pricing.
What does that mean?
That's surge pricing.
They're saying this company statement says this was misconstrued in some media reports as an intent to raise prices when the demand is highest at our restaurants. Instead, they say digital menu boards could allow us to change the menu offerings at different times of day and offer discounts and value offers to our customers more easily, particularly in the slower times of day. So it's not surge pricing. It's actually downtime discount pricing.
We'll see.
Yeah, I think they were caught on their rear end.
Right.
And they don't want you to call it surge pricing, but it's surge pricing. When the price of a thing is higher at a higher demand point, that's surge pricing. You can't, you like, it doesn't, it functionally, it doesn't make a difference. Like, well, no, it's not that prices are higher when demand is high. It's that prices are lower when demand is low. Like, that's the same thing.
Yeah.
That's, what a ridiculous statement.
It is ridiculous. All right, Wendy's. I can't believe they did that. I did hear from a podcast today that there's a college bar in Wisconsin that would do stock market night. And so if you went in and you bought, say, a Bud Light, the stock price of Bud Light would go up. So say it's like a dollar, it'd be like $1.15. And then stock prices for things would go down. Like if the market crashes and for like an hour, nobody orders Bud Light, dude, Bud Light's 45 cents now. And everybody's like, yo, take some Bud Light. It'd be fun. That's a fun night. It's really complicated. But now with technology computers, you could probably pull it off. Okay.
Well, with surge pricing, all they can count on is when I see surge pricing, that's when these tires are going to roll over to McDonald's. Give me a cheap burger.
Oh, wow. But wait, hold on.
Thank you.
There it is. Okay. So let's talk.
I'm glad I got the chance to deploy that.
Yeah, not bad. What did you want to say, Chris? Wendy's what?
Wendy's jokes run out.
Oh, okay.
Let's get to the content.
Let's talk about pessimism, depression, and sadness.
Yeah, let's change the tone real quick. Let's turn it blue, in fact.
Whoa. You like that?
Blue Panther. So the segue that we've been struggling with for the past several moments is about getting us to a really neat game theory concept that gets to human biases and our natural disposition, I think, to be pessimistic. Oh. And it's appropriately kind of informally called the blue dot effect.
Yeah.
You heard of this?
Had you
heard of this before we talked about it?
No, I did not. That's a good, great qualifier. Yeah. Yes, I have heard of it for the show, but no, I had not heard about it before we talked about it.
Yeah, so it's one of these concepts that I think the way I described it to my beloved when I was talking about our plans for this episode was that it kind of reads like something that people who post on LinkedIn about leadership and like lessons and stuff like that, people who really go hard in on LinkedIn would really love the blue dot effect.
Yeah, I saw the blue dot effect posted in an article on LinkedIn.
Yeah, see, that's my exact point. It's a kind of concept that works with managerial points of view. I mean, managers can understand this about the behavior of their employees. People who are doing scientific research can understand this. In fact, it's based on actual, genuine research that was done at Harvard University, and we'll get into that later on.
For sure.
But the basic idea is that people's concepts, people's mental constructions of what they're working with in the world is so variable, and it can change even when you're dealing with real concrete decisions and discrete items, stuff that requires a minimum level of abstraction. People already are kind of predisposed to have a malleable approach to whatever the concept is. And it's about when people are looking for something, they will find it, even if it's not really there.
So it also builds into a general, the blue dot experiment, I guess, the Harvard research, and we should get into and explain that. But the one thing to kind of look out for, the conclusions that people drew, and this is backed up a lot by things that I know a little bit more about, which is the news, and then also the TikTok algorithm, which is something I've been fascinated by for years, that your predispositions, and this kind of filters into what we were talking about with the Raven paradox, what you already know is going to impact how you view other things, and that your predispositions are going to create further predispositions. I think a great word for this on the internet is rabbit hole. When you start consuming content, you rabbit hole yourself, and that's just because you may not know that you're looking for it, but you're looking for it, and then you keep looking for it, and you go deeper and deeper and deeper. But when you get to the blue dot,
you rabbit hole yourself, but not in the fun way.
It's not a fun rabbit holing. It's a dark rabbit holing. And let me tell you, if you're not taking golf tutorials, maybe you're just consuming horrible, depressive eating disorder content. So, let's get into what the blue dot experiment was, because it is incredibly fascinating. When they added, there's an element at the end where they added some incentives, and I'm sure that whenever scientists do that and the people still go against the incentives, they must have just been flabbergasted. But we'll get to that. Let's start at the top with what the blue dot experiment is.
So I first heard about the blue dot watching just kind of like random YouTube shorts when I was wasting time on some Saturday afternoon, and it turns out that this, you can't trust YouTube shorts. Like, do not take your news from those things. Like, they're not
another word for
the
them
world
are TikToks.
Accurately. Just, yes, they're TikToks. They're TikToks. They're just crappy, no, like empty calories for your brain. Do not learn from this. However, in this rare case, this guy said, oh, yeah, this was done by Harvard researchers. They identified this thing called the blue dot effect. And after some searching, I actually was able to find a dissertation presented by David Emmanuel Livari to the Department of Psychology in partial fulfillment of the requirements for the degree of Doctor of Philosophy in the subject of psychology at Harvard University. This was in May 2018 that presumably now Dr. Livari was presenting his findings in this research. And this is just the most interesting thing, that the title of this thesis that Livari did was called Prevalence-Induced Concept Change in Human Judgment. Prevalence-Induced Concept Change. So that's the kind of building block here. So he doesn't call it the blue dot effect. The reason that this YouTube guy, this TikToker, called it the blue dot effect deals with the kind of experiment that Livari was running with this. And so I'm gonna quote extensively from the abstract here. So Dr. Livari, excellent work. I hope you listen to this someday and admire your own words being read back to you. So the abstract begins, why do social problems seem so intractable? Mm-hmm. So pretty broad scope here.
Sure.
He continues, in a series of experiments, I show that people often respond to decreases in the prevalence of a stimulus by, quote, expanding their concept. And the quotation marks are added. They're actually in the abstract. They respond to the presence of a stimulus by expanding their concept of it. When blue dots became rare, participants began to see purple dots as blue. When threatening faces became rare, participants began to see neutral faces as threatening. When unethical requests became rare, participants began to see innocuous requests as unethical. And he says, this prevalence-induced concept change occurred when participants were forewarned about it, and even when they were instructed and paid to resist it. So the basic idea is that when people are told to look for a thing, and they're shown a sample of many things of different types, they're going to inject their mental construct of that thing into the sample or into their observations and find it, whether it's actually there or not.
Yes.
And that, so it's called the blue dot effect because by showing people a bunch of differently colored dots that are different shades of purple to blue or whatever, and telling them, I need you to find all the blue dots here. People will quickly find, okay, this one's blue, this one's blue, this one's not, this one's not. And then they identify all the blue dots. But then when they're shown a series of other dots, none of which are blue, but many of which are in that kind of like purplish range, they expand their concept of what counts as blue. Right. In other words, they change their concept in response to the prevalence of the thing that they're looking for. And they say, well, you know, under my new definition of blue, these ones that previously wouldn't have counted, they count now. It's kind of like, when I read about this, it kind of reminded me of like the mental equivalent of going to the refrigerator when you want to eat something, but you're not really hungry and you're looking for like a tasty snack and you scan through all the ingredients and leftovers and whatever's in your fridge and you go, you know, I'm just not feeling any of this stuff. And you walk away for a minute, you lower your standards and you go back to the fridge.
And then you take a pull of the maple syrup, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. Like, well, now that my standards are lower, I think I could go for a swig of some raw sugar that I would normally reserve for my pancakes. Or that cheese, like, it's not that moldy. If I just scrape the mold off the hard part, the rest of it's probably pretty good.
It's probably fine.
So in other words, the blue dot effect is when people see blue dots because they've changed their definition of what blue is, and they've been told to look for blue dots, or they're incentivized to find blue dots in a sample. And it doesn't matter whether there actually are or aren't.
It gets worse than that because what they're looking for. As part of the experiment, they incentivized people with $10 with actual money to get it correct. They also warned participants that blue dots, the number of blue dots is going to increase or decrease, excuse me. The number of blue dots is going to decrease in the next round of dots you're shown. And they still screwed it up. They continually screwed it up. And again, like you said, when they were shown neutral faces or threatening faces in the same way, so blue dots and purple dots, but neutral faces or threatening faces. And that one is crazy to me because that means you just start to become suspicious of mankind. That's a kind of a dark way to experiment about this. But people are looking for threatening faces. That's the thing that they're excluding from the group. So when they look for threatening faces, they find threatening faces. Like, you're going to find what you're looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to get into, probably at the end of the episode, I want to get into the like kind of social implications. This is not a politics podcast, but there are major, major social and political implications for this thing of like people, when people are looking for something, they're going to find it. And that includes like the attitudes that they project onto other people when they're trying to find people, pick them out from a crowd. But there was an interesting piece that I was also able to find about this from a Medium article. This is from Nishith Goyal.
Yep, good one.
Wrote this in May 2023. The title of this article is Understanding the Blue Dot Effect, the Hidden Bias Impacting Our Choice. And I liked this one because I happen to know, I know a few people who are in the kind of like risk mitigation or safety space, or industrial safety space. It made me think in particular of a friend of mine named Hannah. Shout out to Hannah, who is a safety inspector basically for a really technical field, and there's a lot of really intense, pretty dangerous kind of work. And Hannah described to me once that her job is basically trying to hinder or prevent others from doing their job. So if there are scientists or engineers or technicians who need to go on to work, Hannah's responsibility is, okay, I got to find some safety things. I got to make sure that all the safety parameters that we have in accordance with this specific system, they're all checked off and good to go. And so my job is to make it difficult for these people to do their job, because if I don't, then the safety risks are elevated. And so I kind of played through that conversation as I was reading this article by Nishith. And the reason for that is that it starts off with asking some kind of questions. So here's one. Have you ever wondered why, despite rigorous checks and controls, internal compliance teams always seem to discover issues?
Yep.
So it's like, so it's like if somebody's job is to say, all right, you have to find and solve all our problems so that we make sure we're maximally compliant. So even if you have the best system of safeguards and the best system of checks and balances, and you have the most rigorous procedures, and you've done the most vetting, and you've really rung all of your processes through the ringer and made sure that you're going to be in compliance, the compliance team is there incentivized to try to find problems. And I think that's just super, super interesting. And it speaks to me about the incentives that people have when they go in trying to solve a problem. It's not always just about finding a solution. Sometimes there are other factors at play that influence not only their decisions, but their perceptions in the first place.
Yeah. So that's part of this that, and I don't have access to the full original academic study, but the juice of a paper, if you're an academic nerd, and I used to read quite a bit of medical literature for my job, but I also, when I had JSTOR, I'm such a nerd, and I can't believe I'm disclosing this.
Oh, yes. Back when I used to have JSTOR. Yeah, congratulations. You went to college.
I used to look up academic papers on the movies and TV shows I was watching, because I just wanted to know what the nerds thought. It's fun for me. I like doing that. But the methods section of what you're looking at is always where the juice is. That's always where the good shit is, because that's where you can find out what questions they were asking. So the big thing in this paper, I would assume, that they discussed in the discussion section of saying that we didn't do this, was that if they had been looking for purple dots, would this also have happened? Or what happens when you switch what people are looking for and keep them the same or tinker with the amount? Because the thing in my brain is that you start out looking for blue dots and then you're looking for blue dots, right? Like if you keep looking for this, it's the same thing. I've said this on the show a couple of times. I would love to read an academic paper or two about the movie Inception. This is Inception. You say, look for blue dots. You can't stop looking for blue dots. And you're like obsessed with that could be a blue dot. It looks bluish from this angle. And on one hand, it becomes your eyes. On the other hand, it's your brain not really able to just simply assess the information in front of you at a single glance. Now, I want to kind of move the conversation into news, because this is a very simple thing in the news. This is like day one of journalism school, if it's even worth being in a school. It's if it bleeds, it leads. It's something that people have talked. And that's Freud, right? If it bleeds, it leads. You ever heard this?
That's okay. That I just want to say,
yeah,
that sounds really risky to build a life philosophy on. If it bleeds, it leads.
You've never heard about this?
No,
I thought this
just,
was a phrase.
I feel like that's just like it sounds like.
No,
I don't know. It sounds weird.
Nope. The more if it bleeds, it leads means the more violent it is, the more front page news it is.
Is that the thing that's like Dog Bites Man.
So that's kind of
news.
Kind of, yes. Dog Bites Man is not news. Man Bites Dog is news. So that's kind of a weird angle of it. But if it bleeds, it leads is the more violent, the more scary, the more sexual violence, that will be what does better. And now this is what's really, because me as a person who's studied this, I get really critical of people like the media keep reporting this. Like, no, idiots, you keep clicking on it and buying it. Like that, they won't do it if they didn't do it. And we're going to, there's plenty of data. Every single study that the Poynter Institute or Pew Research or any country ever is, the more negative and scary it is, the more people consume that shit. That's just like a fact. And the Wall Street Journal did an extensive study about TikTok, which proved kind of the same thing about like depression and anxiety disorders, what content people are consuming. So with stuff like this, if you get the blue dot in your brain, as that's what you're looking for, then that's what you're going to find. And if you tie emotion into it, and the most powerful and important human emotion, we know this because of a lot of psychological research, is fear. Fear of death and fear of and not being able to reproduce and fear of hunger, those things drive humanity. So if you tie your obsession with blue dots to fear, this is exactly what happens. But I think that's where the nefarious stuff comes in with the threatening face thing. That was an eye-opening thing to read about.
Yeah, that's a really shocking deal to me. Have you ever heard of this term? It's pareidolia.
No.
Have you ever heard of that?
No.
So I read about this years ago, and it's only really kind of tangentially related to this face identifying blue dot effect. But I thought of it nonetheless because I just like an interesting connection I made. So I'm reading from the Wikipedia here on pareidolia. That the spelling is pareidolia. It says pareidolia is the tendency for perception to impose a meaningful interpretation on a nebulous stimulus, usually visual, so that one detects an object, pattern, or meaning where there is none. Pareidolia is a type of apophenia, which I don't know what that is, so I'm not going to click on that link. But the real kind of big example that comes up is seeing faces in inanimate objects. And even the Wikipedia article comes with a link or with an image here that I'm going to show because we are on the internet now. You can see if you're watching this on YouTube.com, go to our YouTube channel at Game Theory Media. You can see the Danish electrical outlet that it's got here. A nice little image. It looks like there's a little guy, a little smiley face
big
guy.
Big fan of
just
smiles.
A happy dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's an inanimate object.
Yeah.
That's a silly thing that you can find a face in. So this term, this pareidolia, is this natural disposition to impose a meaningful interpretation of something that is otherwise not meaningful. This is just a picture of a wall socket. But because there's something so deeply ingrained in our like primal brains to see and identify others that look like us, like from such an early age, like you can like see when like little newborns catch a glimpse of their unfocused eyes and they see their like parents' emotive face and they like kind of understand it for the first time. You can see that stimulus like dawning on them. They're like, oh my God, this is so wonderful. And that is just so deeply rooted in the human psyche that like now I can look at this piece of plastic and go, oh, what a nice little guy. And I've completely mapped this entire concept onto this thing that is otherwise just a meaningless chunk of plastic. And I think that's such an interesting thing. And like when you consider that, how that natural disposition pairs up with the different stimuli and different incentives that people face when it comes to making decisions about discernment and basing their observation on differentiation and classification of different objects and different persons and situations, you can understand like, all right, we're naturally disposed to think of this stuff and categorize it in a specific way. And that can lead to people to like make real genuine mistakes. And it can really skew judgment in a way that has really bad effects.
Yeah, for sure. And so Brandon Spector wrote an article for LiveScience.com around the time that this was published, analyzing the paper.
Is that LiveScience or LiveScience?
LiveScience. I'm LiveScience. It's got a V in it.
I thought it was LiveScience. I've never heard LiveStrong.
I've actually never. Oh, is it a LiveStrong brand?
I don't know. I feel like I personally became aware of it around the same time.
That that makes sense. It does. That's a great question. We'll find that out. We'll have to figure that out.
That was back when we all thought that Lance Armstrong had five times as many legit Tour de France's as he had balls.
Yeah, he. Who's we? Whoops. I mean,
it's Sorry.
Like everybody was watching. I was like, oh, this is amazing, right? Like, I get it. How do I put this very lightly? Taylor Swift is starting to have Lance Armstrong vibes. That's all I'm going to say.
Stop. You need to stop that right now.
I just, something's
weird. Swifties out there, we love you.
We love you.
Nothing wrong. She could do no wrong. She's
first
the
time I saw
angel.
Her in concert, she was not a headline act, so get off my ass. I have my credentials.
Whatever. When did you see?
It's December of 06, 07. She opened for Rascal Flatts in Denver.
Oh.
Yeah.
Why were you in Denver in 06?
To see Rascal Flatts
there.
With my friends. You were going to go to Denver to watch a country concert? No, you would never that.
Well,
let's talk about Brandon Spector and LiveLiveScience.com. So Brandon Spector, he wrote an article analyzing the paper that came out, and he says, he kind of paraphrases the dark purpose of this, or the dark interpretations of this. If your brain is, the quoting now, if your brain is constantly recalibrating its perceptions based on prior experiences, like looking for blue dots, how can you be sure you've ever really seen things as they are? Looking at the bigger picture, can human societies ever truly solve their problems, crime, poverty, prejudice, etc., if they're constantly expanding their definition of those problems to include fresh transgressions, which can make it feel like progress is being made, but it can make it feel as if no progress is being made and things are worse than ever. Does this sound familiar?
Yeah, it sounds really familiar because, in fact, we talked about this really recently on this show. It sounds to me like that's like a career activist.
Yep.
And when we pointed this out, like the thing that we said, like I frankly was complaining, but what we said was, okay, if your career job is to advocate for something, then the fulfillment of that career, that fulfillment of that advocacy is to continually be making arguments in favor of, or taking actions in favor of, or doing something to advance the cause of this particular set of issues. And like any job or any career, part of the incentive of having that career, like, well, you know, you want to make things better for people. And I believe that activists genuinely believe in their causes. Otherwise, they wouldn't be very good activists. But another part of that is you got to kind of justify your own existence. You got to perpetuate your own status, your own prestige, your own ability to bring in money and bring in attention to the cause and all that kind of stuff. So what that means is, on the one hand, you push for progress and you make real change. And I think activism really is genuinely a force for good in the world. On the other hand, when you make progress and you achieve results and you get what you wanted, there's not an incentive to stop and say, all right, great, that's what we wanted. I'm going to move on from this now. What there is an incentive to say, okay, that's great, but we're just getting started. Or now we need to expand our mission. Now that we've achieved progress in this area, we need to go into the next area. Or we need to expand progress for another group of people. And what it results in is this self-perpetuating body of work wherein people are naturally disposed to see meaning where there really isn't any.
Yep.
And they're also inclined to try to fulfill the brief. I'm trying to do my job as an activist, and if I'm not advocating for the solution to problems, then I'm not doing that job. So therefore, I need to find problems to try to solve.
Yeah.
And it goes back to the compliance example. Like, why does a compliance team always find problems? Well, that's because they're incentivized to do so. That's why the compliance team exists. Otherwise, it feels like to the person who's on that team or to the activist who's in that job, it feels like if I don't come up with a problem, then I'm not really doing my job. I'm not fulfilling my responsibilities in this.
So I think it's like anything else that we discuss, which is that it's got to be taken on a case-by-case basis. It simply can't be lumped into multiple things, because I agree with you and I disagree with you based on one piece of evidence, which was just the movie Charlie Wilson's War, which is a fictional tale about a real covert operation where I think the CIA funded the United States government funded resistance and weaponry for Afghanis on the ground.
So Charlie Wilson's War, it really did happen. Charlie Wilson was a congressman from the 7th District of Texas. Yep. He was, you know, he has a colorful character that is dramatized by Aaron Sorkin and company on the silver screen.
Tom Hanks nails it.
Played by Tom Hanks.
Unbelievable.
Absolutely nails it. Philip Seymour Hoffman nails it. Julia Roberts nails it. Incredible movie. Go watch the movie if you can.
Amy Adams, her first big role.
Yes, Amy Adams played an excellent congressman's assistant who is rightly indignant at his behavior. But the point of that movie was that this congressman found the set of issues kind of by accident. He was just kind of a career politician having fun. Like the first scene of the movie is him like basically doing blow in a hot tub.
Not doing blow. In Vegas. It was made very
not
clear.
Doing blow. Yes. Allegedly.
Allegedly.
In a hot tub in Vegas with some strippers. But anyway, this guy finds himself. So he's on the House Foreign Affairs Committee,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And he's in charge of some subcommittee that allows him to make decisions about the budget. And he suddenly finds himself going from a $5 million budget to help the Afghanistan resistance fighters, the Mujahideen, fight this big, bad Soviet Union military that just invaded the country.
Right.
And then he takes it from $5 million and expands it, you know, 100-fold. And suddenly he's helping the people of Afghanistan defeat their Soviet occupiers, and it was like this huge moment in world history. Big old deal.
Where were you going with this? Where I'm going with this is that the budget goes from 5 million to a billion, and we defeat the Soviets. The Americans defeat the Soviets through the people who are doing the actual suffering on the ground, which is the fighters in the hills of Afghanistan. It was the Vietnam of the Soviet Union. It really stifled the spread of communism.
That's a good comparison.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it was. However, at the end of the movie, the quote from the person who played Philip Seymour Hoffman was, "We fucked up the end game," which was that everyone's like, "Oh, we did it. We bailed out."
And no, that was Charlie Wilson.
Was it Charlie Wilson who said that we fucked up the end game? This is a quote. So he said that, which to me implies exactly what you're saying. Like we mission accomplished. The implication here is that many people have drawn to the way that we gave people in Afghanistan all of these weapons and just kind of bailed on them. And I'm not saying the United States should have funded the reconstruction of Afghanistan or whatever, but the idea is that what about world history is different if Americans had seen it through and maybe hung around and built a couple schools and rec centers and stuff for a couple of years? Is anything different? I don't know. But that was the implication that I got from Charlie Wilson's quote, was like, okay, we won the war and then we just left. So it's kind of the opposite of what you're saying. Like, but it's case by case. Like, and how hindsight's 20/20. Like, at one point are you obsessing about things, and at what point are you just, is it time to call a mission a success? So Spector, I think we'll say Brandon Spector was the guy that wrote this. He quotes an excerpt from the paper in the conclusion, which is this, quote, "Although modern societies have made extraordinary progress in solving a wide range of social problems, from poverty to illiteracy to violence to infant mortality, the majority of people believe that the world is getting worse," unquote, which is kind of what this blue dot theory supposes, which is that if you look for blue dots, if you look for is it getting worse, it's getting worse. And the research that we have about how much more people like negative news shows that, and has shown that for a long time.
It has. And we talked about it on this show when we talked about having this disconnect between the state of how the economy is doing and how the economy is actually doing. We asked the question, as so many others did, if everything is going really well for us, why does it feel like there's a vibe session? Like, why are things just a little bit off? And I think part of that has to do with, like, okay, if you think about the baby example, like you're trained as a baby, it's like bred into your genetic blueprint or whatever.
Yep.
By the way, genes aren't the whole story, but so just bear with me with the blueprint thing. If it's bred into your blueprint that you recognize faces and you like imprint onto faces and project meaning into them, then there are probably other ways to kind of train your brain to project different types of meanings onto that. And so if you have a society that becomes addicted to social media because they want the dopamine rush of figuring out what their friends are doing and engaging with news, and if you have a society where everybody has access to that social media and this quick calorie-free content or these empty calories for your brain right in the palm of their hand with smartphones, and companies are incentivized to generate clicks and engagement rather than meaningful pursuits, match group, then what you're doing is reinforcing people's perceptions of the world that they're consuming, and people tend to naturally gravitate to stories that, like, if it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah.
If it's violent, if it's morbid, if it's depressing, if it's rage inducing. You said the most powerful motivator is fear. Another powerful motivator is rage.
Yeah.
People love to feel the righteous fury of knowing that they're right, the other guys are wrong, and all we got to do is take back the power and defeat the other guys. People love to feel that way, especially when they can do so from the comfort of their couch, scrolling on their smartphone, just getting angry at stuff.
Exactly.
And so as we reinforce this perception, what that means is not only am I just consuming more and more and more of this stuff and feeding myself, I'm actually turning into someone who is now looking for more things to be mad at. It's not enough that there's an endless stream and the algorithms are perfectly crafting these stories to accommodate my particular flavor of being enraged by the news. It's also that now my brain is changing, my behavior is changing, my observations are changing. My concepts are adjusting in real time of what constitutes a thing that is rage-worthy or a thing that is worth my engagement. And so now I'm looking for this stuff everywhere. And so then what the result of that is going to be is that, like, even when things are good, even when there's nothing to be mad at, even when I don't really have any enemies, I don't have any haters, even when the economy is good, I'm doing okay, and so are all of my neighbors. Everyone's standard of living is better than it's ever been. Inflation is down low. The stock market's looking great. Everything is good. Even then, I'm now inclined to find things to be upset about and find reasons to be dissatisfied, to try to stir the pot and look for problems. My incentives have fundamentally changed because my concept of what constitutes a stimulus has completely changed.
There are questions about whether or not and how and to what degree some of this is natural. And if you believe that fear of death motivates humans the way it motivates essentially all mammals that we study, then that makes a ton of sense. So Dylan Matthews, a journalist for Vox, kind of broke down a couple pieces of research that highlight that maybe there's a little bit more going on than our just perception, or maybe our perception is revealing the way that we actually are. And again, in journalism school, we were taught if it bleeds, it leads. That's an editorial decision. But now with data, you don't have to make the editorial decision. The people make the editorial decision for you. They want to see embarrassment. They want to see laughter. Then they want to see violence. Then they want to see anger. They want to see fear. That's what they click on. So this researcher, Stuart Soroka, in conjunction with his colleagues, Patrick Fournier and Lilac Near, they conducted an 1,100 participant study across 17 countries in which they would measure physical responses. So it would be like they would wear skin conductance and they had blood volume pulse sensors while they watched seven randomly ordered BBC World News stories on a laptop computer. And some of the positive stories were things like a ballet company that employs blind dancers, the popularity of ABBA. Well, negative stories included like a Peruvian town burning down, UN investigations into crimes in Sri Lanka, and ultra-Orthodox activists blocking Israeli girls from going to school. Like stuff that actually happened, right? People say they prefer good news. That's what they want. They want to read good, positive stuff. Their body, their science, the way that they react in an emotional response. Across the sample, quote, they found that the negative news provoked a stronger physiological response and garnered more attention than positive or neutral news on average. Like, that's just a fact. Different cultural backgrounds, different races, different ages, 1,100 people, positive news, negative news from Britain, and they were all, most participants said, I want to read about good stuff, but their bodies were like, no, you don't. You want to read about the bad stuff.
Wow. So whether it's by conditioning or by nature or by something else,
exactly,
people are physiologically inclined to be more interested in the morbid, negative, dark, scary, rage-inducing stuff.
No question. And it gets more interesting with TikTok, because TikTok told people publicly when it came out, and this is according to a number of Wall Street Journal investigations. The Wall Street Journal did an investigation that I should frankly have won journalism awards. Maybe they did. I don't know.
If you worked on this project and you're at the Wall Street Journal and you won this award,
you get the journal. You get the Journal of the Negative Results Journal of the Year awards from our.
Yes, you get the first annual Journal of Negative Results award of recognition, which frankly feels a little bit like an insult. But either way,
I'm sure they are going to put it on their desk. So they created a number of bots and programmed the bots to stop scrolling on content that had hashtags in the content, which TikTok hashtags don't really matter. They matter if you're looking for things, but not if you just want to be algorithm unloaded on, you know, like exactly like your empty calories. So they created these bots to stop on content that had similar hashtags, and so wanted to see how long it took them to get rabbit holed. And what they found was not very long, incredibly fast, and that a similar study by a different group, a children's organization in the United States, found that teens want things about their own current struggles, which are depression, anxiety, ADHD, And at that point, there are teens that have been reporting to the American Psychological Association that they will delete their TikTok account and start over because their algorithms get so infected with this kind of content that they're just so drilled down that they all they get is stuff about self-mutilation, suicide, depression. They can't escape it, which is crazy. Wow. And those kind of thoughts are a natural part of the growing up experience and a very delicate thing for parents and psychologists and children. But if you're just... If this is where you're, if it's one thing, if mom and dad or grandma and grandpa are just stuck watching MSNBC or Fox News all day and you're like, okay, well, this is annoying. I don't like this for you. It's a different thing if a 13-year-old is watching people kind of fetishize suicide. And that has happened. TikTok has cleaned up their act quite a bit, but it happened a lot. And it happened not because they were clicking on it and not because they liked it, not because they commented on it, because it measures watch time. So they watched it two or three times and then that's what they were fed.
So that it sounds like this is the data analytics version of that Netflix yes. show 13 Reasons Why.
Exactly.
It's like romanticizing, or it's building more into this stream of really unhealthy thoughts, behaviors, and consumption for especially for teens who are really vulnerable to that kind of thing. I mean, we had to be taught, you know, don't give out your information on the internet, don't believe everything you read on the internet. And now it's so prevalent that some of that internet safety stuff that we kind of took for granted. It was like, you wear a helmet when you ride your bike, you look both ways when you cross the street, you don't tell anybody anything on the internet, and if you see anything that scares you, you walk away. But it's a lot harder for them to do that now. I mean, everything is just it's just around all the time. And so they're building these unhealthy habits by without really knowing it and without having a whole lot of control over what the algorithm feeds them. And they're now adjusting their concept. They're augmenting their concept of what constitutes good or acceptable content based on how much of it they're consuming. Right. And it's this really unhealthy feedback loop, and it's not a good thing.
Yeah.
And man, it's discouraged. Like, we're talking about, oh man, people look for all these reasons to be discouraged and be upset about it. And here we are, like, as we're talking about this, I'm like, man, this really sucks.
Yeah, it does.
It
does.
Not, but this is not good.
It's our general thesis and our tagline, boring is hot. Like, it being well informed and having a sharp mind, it's a lot like working out, which you and I don't really know that much about anymore, but it is theoretically a lot like working out in that it's difficult. It's hard. It takes effort to engage yourself.
I left my memories of working out in my other hard drive. I need to plug that in and remember what it's like. Mm-hmm.
Get off of social media. But that's exactly...
Like, I'm a podcaster. I can't work out. Okay. If you podcast and work out, like, you're going to become Joe Rogan, and we don't want that.
Yeah, we definitely don't. I don't want to be firing an archery arrow into a truck to prove how tough the truck is, which is the greatest clip in the history of the internet.
That sounds pretty baller. I would love to watch it.
But so, like, this teenage organization made 8 dummy TikTok accounts posing as 13-year-olds to act as 13-year-old would. And they said after a day or two of scrolling on TikTok, they eventually got rabbit hole to the point where there was an eating disorder, depression, or suicide-related video on their For You page every 39 seconds, which is crazy. Ooh. Yeah.
That's wild. And I mean, I don't know how much time people are spending on those apps on average. I mean, obviously, TikTok has all that kind of data.
35% exactly of teens, they think, is over 5 hours a day.
Holy cow. So every 39 seconds, let's just say it's once every minute for 5 hours a day. Holy cow. I mean, that you're getting hundreds and hundreds of these TikToks that could be reinforcing, like, really dangerous.
If you have one, because I've had days where I've been scrolling and the thing that I was doing, like, that evening was scrolling. I was like, you know, instead of watching Netflix, I'm just going to be on my phone for 3 hours and go to bed, which is fine. Yeah. We all do that, whatever. And you go down in a rabbit hole. As an adult, I can wake up the next day and be like, I hate all these videos. And then I, like, TikTok will kind of figure out that I'm done with that theme after a little while, and it'll feed me new stuff. But if you're a kid, if you have one bad day of this, you can't get out of it. And that's what we're saying. They've interviewed teenagers who have had to delete their account to just start fresh and clear cookies and clear the cache, because the TikTok wants you to watch forever. I do want to conclude with one thing that I think is annoying, and I think it might be the downfall of TikTok eventually, which is that they are going after YouTube. They want to be Amazon.com and YouTube. So they're launching a shop. They've launched a shop to compete with Amazon. But they want to compete with YouTube by doing landscape content. So turn your phone sideways. And they want videos now of over a minute. So the TikTok Creator Fund is incentivizing people financially for making videos of longer than a minute. And subsequently, we have published our first 2 TikToks in a couple months. LOL. That doesn't have anything to do with itself. But
I'm sure. There's nothing to worry about.
On TikTok sucks now, in my opinion, because people are just droning on for like 3 minutes trying to get paid. And like, I don't give a shit about this story. Could have been an email.
Truly.
Yeah.
There's this word, and we're, unfortunately, this is going to drive us into the explicit category on Spotify or Apple, wherever you're listening to your podcast. But this is a term that was coined by this guy, Cory Doctorow, who, in 2022. He calls it enshittification.
What?
Enshittification is the pattern of decreasing quality of online platforms and that function as two-sided markets. So basically, it's like all these apps are getting crappier and they're converging together. So there's a quotation from an article that in which I don't know if he wrote or was just published in 2023 in Wired, but the quotation is this. Here's how platforms die. First, they're good to their users. Then they abuse their users to make things better for their business customers. Mm. Finally, they abuse those business customers to claw back at all the value for themselves. Then they die. I call this enshittification, and it is a seemingly inevitable consequence arising from the combination of ease of changing how a platform allocates value, combined with the nature of a two-sided market where a platform sits between buyers and sellers, hold each hostage to the other, raking off an ever larger share of the value that passes between them. So in other words, they're going after, TikTok would be expanding its position in this two-sided market by going after both Amazon and Google or and YouTube, trying to expand with the vertical or the horizontal content and opening up a shop and stuff. They're trying to position themselves between more sets of buyers and sellers and increase their ability to enshittify everything and make a miserable experience. So maybe TikTok will die soon. I don't know.
I think that Reddit and Imgur have been fighting off this exact thing for a number of years and that they'll never die. There's no way.
Yeah. Well, you know, addiction for as bad as bad business models are, as difficult as that is to overcome, addiction is super powerful.
True.
Nick, I want to offer us some potential light at the end of the tunnel.
Let's do
for
it.
This.
Yeah, great.
Maybe some solutions
it's
like
been
how
such
to handle
a happy
this.
Episode.
It really has. Well, I think there are basically two things that we can do as game theorists to optimize our
players,
approach
what might
to say. This. Players, yes. Player haters, even, in fact. I think there are two things. It's really kind of the same thing, but at two different levels. So first of all, we kind of, one of the things we love about doing episodes on bias on this show is that we get to examine those biases in ourselves. Mm. Have either of us improved any measurable degree from learning about those biases? No. But we do admire the problem. We stand around and admire the problem in ourselves.
We are like men at Home Depot, the Home Depot theme song in the background.
That's exactly right. But player three, that does not have to stop with us. You can be better than us. In fact, we know you're better
than
us.
You probably are better than us. Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody knows that. So I think acknowledging this bias in the self and going, okay, yeah, am I blue dotting this? Am I pareidolying this and imposing my own standard of values or my own perception or my own concept, my own abstraction onto this scenario? So that's a personal thing. But the second thing deals with this story that I heard a long time ago. And I don't know if I can't remember where I heard this, but this is a story about the decoy. And I think I've talked about this on the show.
I'm excited about this.
Like I said, I don't know where I first read this, but I do know that there's this bwigs.com is the website of Brian Wigginton. And it's a bunch of, I think it's like a true old school blog. And there's this post here that's called the Queen's Duck. And I'm not going to read the whole thing aloud, but I am going to quote some of this. And I think this is like an apocryphal story, but you can just imagine this playing itself out in like a real software design company. So there's this artist working on animating the queen for a battle chess software program. And it says the artist working on these queen animations came up with an innovative solution to the problem of an overbearing manager. So there's a product manager who says, engineers, I need you to build in these features and I need it to come in at this schedule and budget, blah, blah, blah. So the artist who would be working on this knows that there's this overbearing middle manager who has to report up to the executive bosses, but also has to exert downward control onto the employees. Sure. In other words, if this person isn't doing something at all times, then they're not really fulfilling their responsibility. And their job is to be the go-between between the working level and the executive level. So they have to feel like they're doing something. So the innovative solution to dealing with this person is The artist did the animations for the queen in the way that he felt would be best, with one addition. He gave the queen a pet duck. He animated this duck through all of the queen's animations, had it flapping around in the corners. He also took great care to make sure that it never overlapped with the actual piece animation. Story continues, eventually it became time for the producer to review the animation set for the queen. The producer sat down and watched all the animations. When they were done, he turned to the artist and said, "That looks great. Just one thing. Get rid of the duck." So the point is, if you're able to understand that, okay, this guy, this producer, this middle manager has an incentive to try to look for something, because if he doesn't report up to the executive something, then it doesn't look like he's doing his job.
Yep.
It feels there's a certain insecurity attached with saying, yep, no edits, this is good to go. No comments, you're fine. It feels like you're going to be perceived as not having done your job.
Totally.
And so when you're dealing with someone who's blue dotting, or when you recognize that people could possibly be blue dotting, A, acknowledge that it may not necessarily
and
be
and program a duck in your work.
Right. And B, program a duck into your work. Build that accountability and that understanding. And obviously, not everybody's a software engineer. You can't just build ducks into everything. But what you can do is approach situations with a little bit more empathy, a little bit more patience, and a little bit more creativity about how you can account for the possibility that you or the person that you're dealing with or group that you're dealing with may have a tendency toward pareidolia and blue dotting, as we all do, Nick.
Yeah, we that's certainly true, Chris. I've often thought about, I thought that it would be a fun job to help people wedding dress shop after watching Say Yes to the Dress. And you find out, even if you know the best dress for the woman, maybe bring it out on the third or fourth one so you don't complete, because what she's really there for is to drink champagne and have a good time. So bring the one that she wants, right, not out on the first one.
Lead, follow, or get the hell out of the way, because it's about the champagne and the third dress.
Third dress, that's right. Just right.